tuned in to the Community Cats podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hey there, this is Kristen, the podcast's technical tabby. You'll be hearing from Stacey LeBaron, our usual fabulous host, who's been helping save cats for more than two decades with a number of organizations, including the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, a little later in this episode. But I'm just popping in before it begins to let you know this is part one of a special episode entitled Return to Field, How Shelters Save Community Cats. It's an audio-only version of an advanced webinar that was presented by our friends of the show, Brian Cordes and Susie Richmond, who are the resident experts over at Neighborhood Cats. In this first part, you're going to get the basics of why return to field is good for cats and the community, what field actually means, and you'll get some great examples of how and why return to field programs help reduce feral cat populations and reduce the amount of intake in euthanasia in shelters. Brian's also going to chat a little bit about some of the things we assume about free-roaming cats that aren't actually true, and how you can better communicate with public officials when you're trying to influence cat-related policy. There's also going to be a brief bit of Q&A in the end. If you love this show and want to attend a live webinar that's kind of like it, we have Trapper Tips and Tricks coming up on Saturday, March 23rd from 2 to 4 Eastern Time. And that's totally free to check it out. You do have to save your virtual seat, though. So to do that, you're just going to hop on over to communitycatspodcast.com/trap tips, and you're going to register there. So once again, communitycatspodcast.com/trap tips. And don't forget, if you want to see this presentation in its entirety with all of the visuals, and trust me, you do, not only does it enhance this great info, but there's amazing videos that we had to cut for the audio version that you absolutely must see. You can go to communitycatspodcast.com/everythingTNR and check out that recording on the playlist we've compiled with all the fantastic presentations Neighborhood Cats has done with the podcast. So, I hope you enjoy the show. Don't forget that the goal of this podcast is to help you turn your passion for cats into action. And I hope you come away from this episode with a whole bunch of new ideas for how you can do that for cats in your community. Enjoy the show.
So, we have Susie Richmond as the Executive Director of Neighborhood Cats, having served in that role since 2010. She oversees hands-on TNR in New York City, Jersey City, and on the island of Maui, as well as using her prior Madison Avenue advertising experience to write, among other things, crowdfunding appeals to help the many sick and injured cats who come Neighborhood Cats way. One of her favorite projects currently is a veterinary scholarship program designed to train community cat-oriented vets on high-volume spay-neuter techniques. When she's not in the office, you can find Susie out in the fields of Maui, where she's recently passed the 1,000 cats trapped mark. Brian Cordes serves as Neighborhood Cats National Program Director and Susie Richmond's husband. Back in 1999, while working in Manhattan as both an attorney and a video director, Brian co-founded Neighborhood Cats after TNRing a colony near where he lived. Except for a six-year stint as a grants manager for PetSmart Charities, he has been with the organization ever since. He has authored or co-authored handbooks in grassroots TNR, community TNR, and return to field programs. You can always find him online, where he regularly presents with both basic and advanced webinars on all things trap, neuter, return in partnership with the Community Cats podcast. All right, we're going to turn it over to Brian.
Okay, thank you so much, Stacey, and thank you everybody for taking time out today to learn about this valuable program. I want to reiterate what Stacey said about the slides are one of the handouts. So you don't need to kind of scramble and take notes. Just download the file. And in the PDF file, all the links are live. So you don't have to worry about trying to track those down either. You should be able to click on them in the handout itself. Okay, so let's get started. So today's webinar is actually part of a series that we've done for the first time this year in partnership with the Community Cats podcast on community TNR. I'll talk towards the end of the session about, we do a lot of kind of educational work on the grassroots side of this, on the hands-on, directly working with the cats. But we thought it would be as important too for people who are looking to organize on a larger scale, you know, a county program or a city program or your town. So the first one we did was mobilizing the community to engage in TNR, And the second one was on targeted TNR, which is allocating your resources in a very strategic way to get the most impact on a community level. Both of those are recorded. And if you click on the YouTube links in this slide, it will take you to those sessions. You can also always go to the CommunityCatsPodcast.com's Community Cat Care Training and Education page to find these and find the links. So today's our third in this series on return to field. So it's really, the idea is that when you, your ideal community TNR program is going to have all three of these elements going on at the same time. And towards that, another one of the handouts is a book that I wrote on, it's called Community TNR Tactics and Tools, published by PetSmart Charities. So if you're interested in also reading about these other parts of a community TNR program and how Return to Field fits in, just have a look at that book. And then also, finally, another handout is the Return to Field Handbook, which is published by the Humane Society of the United States and was co-authored by them, Neighborhood Cats, and Alley Cat Advocates, which is a TNR organization based in Louisville, Kentucky. Everything we talk about today, you can go into the book and research it in more depth. There's lots of forms. It's very much meant to, if you have a return to field program that you want to improve, or you're looking to start one, this is a reference guide for you. So we don't want organizations to have to start from scratch. And this will at the very least give you ideas. You may do things a bit differently, but you won't have to start from scratch. If you want a print copy, click on that link and you can purchase one from HSUS. Okay, so before we get started into return to field, I think it's important to define terms because we all know what we're talking about. So what do we mean when we're talking about a community cat? Well, generally they're free roaming and they're unowned in any kind of traditional sense of ownership. So socialization, what's important to understand is that their socialization level can range from very friendly to extremely feral. So that's why the term community cat came in, because when I started, we used to just call them all feral cats. And then the field kind of learned over time that a lot of them aren't feral, or that feral is really not a black or white thing, that there's a continuum of behavior. So community cat came to be the favored term. These cats are often part of a colony. And we define a colony as a group of cats who share a common food source and a common territory. So what is return to field? Well, this graphic just shows it real simply. You have, if you start on the upper left, you've got your community cat who's, roaming around in his territory unaltered. Somebody traps him. And when it comes to return to field, that's usually somebody who is not particularly fond of the kitty, or for some reason does not want the cat at that location. It's not, if somebody is looking to trap the cat, get the cat spayed or neutered, and then return him to his location, we would describe that as your traditional trap, neuter, return effort. Return to field is a bit different because the people who are bringing the cat in are not particularly interested in the cat coming back, or don't really care one way or another. So the cat is trapped and brought to the shelter either by a private citizen or perhaps an ACO. Now, it traditionally, if this cat was feral, unsocialized, or if the shelter was too crowded, then euthanasia was the outcome. With return to field, instead, there's a further pathway, which is the cat is spayed or neutered, given a day or two to recover, and then driven right back to where he came from. And you can see now he's ear tipped and he's released back into his territory. And the criteria for this, we'll talk about that in more detail, but basically if the cat is healthy and appears to be thriving in his territory when he came in, then the cat is placed back. Obviously, if the cat is sick or there's extenuating circumstances that would make it too dangerous at that location, then the cat is not returned. But if he was thriving and he was doing well, even though we can't identify who's feeding him, we know he has a food source, and we trust that most likely he'll continue to do well if he's put back there, but now at least he won't be reproducing. So the origins of this program go back to 2008 with a group called No More Homeless Pets that operates a high-volume spay-neuter clinic in Jacksonville, which you can see on the upper right of this map of Florida. And what happened there was the head of First Coast No More Homeless Pets met with the head of the local animal control agency, which operated the municipal shelter. And in order to promote the practice of trap neuter return, the First Coast No More Homeless Pets person, who his name is Rick Ducharme, he asked the head of the animal control agency if he could be alerted when ear-tipped cats were turned into the municipal shelter so they would have an opportunity to return them to their colonies. So that helps promote trap neuter return, because people know if they get their cats fixed and ear-tipped, if they ever end up at the shelter, they're going to have an opportunity to get them back. So the director of the Jacksonville agency thought about it, and he came back with an offer to let First Coast take all the community cats, not just the ones that were ear-tipped, have them spay-neutered and return them to their original territories. And, you know, that was a little overwhelming since they were taking in about 14,000 cats a year. But Rick was up for the challenge and accepted it, and Return to Field was born. Here's what it looks like, and this is why it has become such a popular program. You can see in the year before Return to Field began, they were taking in the blue bar, close to 14,000 cats, and euthanizing over 11,000. So fast forward to 2014, and they're taking in just under 6,000 cats and euthanizing several hundred. So really just an incredibly dramatic reduction in both intake and, most importantly, as you can see, in euthanasia, from over 11,000 to, you know, probably less than 500. And another interesting thing about this graph is if you look at the green bar, the red being euthanasia, the green bar are the number of cats who are being returned to field. And you could see in 2008 that if you look at the difference in the drop in euthanasia from 2007 to 2008, pretty much equal to the number of cats who were returned to field in 2008. That green bar makes the difference. And then going in 2009 was the first full year, so they had about 5,000 cats returned to field. And then every year after that, it started going down. So it was a very successful program, not only in lowering euthanasia, but in sparking TNR activity in the community and teaching the community that fixing community cats is the way to manage this, not by dropping them off and euthanizing them. And eventually there were fewer and fewer cats that had to be returned to field. So what are the benefits of this program that we've, you know, now that we have, you know, several years of experience with it? About 15 years, but it's really become much more popular, I would say, in the last five. So we know you're going to have lower euthanasia, right? Because every cat that is put back out there is, not every cat, but most of them probably would have been euthanized in a more traditional system. So that frees up resources to use, because euthanizing cats is a pretty expensive program if you're doing it on a very large scale. You know, if you're euthanizing 11,000 cats a year and it's costing you over $100 a cat between the trapping and the shelter, you know, taking care of them for the mandatory hold time and the euthanasia procedure and the disposal of the body. Well, you multiply that times 11,000 or however many you have, that your euthanasia rate goes down. And that is money you can spend on other things that are more life-saving or productive. You might have a dog behavior program. You might have a TNR program, whatever it is. You end up with a shelter that is less crowded. So you have less disease spreading in the environment. We found that the public loves this program, that if you are saving lives as opposed to ending them, you're much more likely to attract donations. More people are going to come to the shelter to adopt your animals. Inside the shelter in terms of, and outside in terms of a culture change, also we see often really dramatic changes. So inside the shelter, you know, most people don't get into animal welfare because they want to end the animals' lives. You know, they want to save them. And it can be extremely stressful to be working at a facility that has a high euthanasia rate, especially if a lot of those animals are healthy. So when all of a sudden the dynamic changes from ending lives to saving them, it is highly motivating to staff. And an example of that, one of my favorite examples is in San Antonio, when a return to field program started, and this was through a grant from Best Friends and PetSmart Charities, where I was working at the time. San Antonio was such a large city. It's like got over a million people that, you know, we realized our grant was not going to be large enough to have an impact on the city as a whole. So we basically gave a grant to half the city, and the cats coming in from the half that was covered by the grant, they would get fixed and they would be returned to field. We couldn't, you know, cover the other half. So actually the animal control officers who worked for the agency, they felt it was very arbitrary. They understood the reason why we had to do that, but they still felt it wasn't really fair that the cat lived or died depending on which zip code that he or she came from. So they went out and got their own grant and to spay and neuter cats outside our target areas. And then on their own time, they drove the cats back and released them themselves. So it, in another shelter in Albuquerque, there was a staffer who was responsible for the euthanasia of the cats. And she had stuck with it for many years through, you know, pretty tough times in terms of how many animals were dying. And when the return to field program started, she asked if she could come along for the release of the first cat. And of course they said yes. And when that trap door opened and the cat ran out, she just burst into tears. And she was just so overcome with seeing an animal that she normally would be responsible for euthanizing and seeing that animal go free. So it's a very, very powerful program inside, outside the shelter. I mentioned before, you're teaching people, you're teaching your community that the way to deal with community cats is through spay neuter, not through drop them off and forget about them and leave the dirty work to someone else. And eventually that becomes the norm. It takes time, but as we saw in Jacksonville, as the return to field program went on, the number of TNR surgeries rapidly rose. You know, the data showed that. I forget the exact numbers, but it went something from like maybe 1,000 to 10,000 over the course of several years as people kind of latched onto the idea of spay neuter. And then, of course, there's always the thing that nobody likes to talk about, which is when a cat is trapped, they tend to act feral, whether or not they actually are, unless they have a significant cooling off period, which is often not something that's possible in a high volume, high euthanasia environment. So we're probably euthanizing any number of pets. But with return to field, you eliminate that risk. You put them back in their territory, and they have an opportunity to go home. So again, why stop euthanizing? Historically, that as a method of managing community cats, it has never shown that there's any improvement in intake and euthanasia rates over time or complaint calls. If you're not reducing the size of the community cat population effectively, then you're not reducing whatever wildlife predation may be going on. And the number of community cats will just stabilize to whatever the carrying capacity of that environment or that community is, meaning how much food and shelter is available to them. Sometimes animal control agencies or municipal shelters think they're doing a great job because the number of cats coming in is steady over time. That actually is a sign of a failure, because all it means is that you've reached carrying capacity and you're having no impact on the population at all. We've talked briefly about the costs of relying on euthanasia, the high stress, high turnover, poor public relations, and that translates into less money coming in and fewer adoptions. So it's important to understand, why does lethal control fail? There's a number of reasons. There's too many cats. There's too few animal control resources to try to catch them all, even if you could. The people who care for the cats resist. They're highly bonded to them. You get the vacuum effect. And if you don't capture all the members of a particular colony, then you're going to end up with just the same number of cats eventually, because you have the same amount of food and shelter available. So this concept of the vacuum effect is really important to understand the futility of trying to euthanize your way through a community cat overpopulation issue. So I want to go over that in a little bit of detail. So let's say we have a colony of 10 cats who are living in the behind or in the parking lot of a grocery store. And every day the grocery store puts out a certain amount of garbage. And unfortunately, the only graphic I could find was of a garbage can. But let's say that was the grocery store's dumpster, and they put out enough, there's enough food in there to support these 10 cats. Somebody complains, the grocery store decides we don't want cats in the lot. So they trap them and they remove them. And since they're feral, they most likely end up euthanized. So what is the problem with this scenario? Why are we not going to stay like this now that the cats are all gone? If you have an idea, chat, you know, put that into the question box. Why doesn't it stay like this? Vacuum effect. Yeah, but give me a little more detail. The garbage is, well, yeah, the garbage is still there. Exactly. There's still food available for cats, right? And this grocery store isn't on an island by itself. Yeah, you're getting it now. The cats move in. And instead, it's in a neighborhood, right? And the surrounding neighborhood has their own cat colonies that are, if they're not TNR'd, they're reproducing and they're outgrowing their own food source. So there's pressure on each of these colonies to find new food sources. And eventually they do. Adam and Eve show up, discover this empty dumpster and empty territory, and they go, you know, this looks like a great place to settle down. You know, let's get married and have a family. And boom, within a couple of breeding cycles, you're right back up to 10 cats. And this is the vacuum effect. When you've removed the cats and you've left the food, you've created a vacuum that will eventually, usually faster than you would think, be filled by cats from surrounding neighborhoods. Now, there's a way out of that, and we go into that in depth in the targeted TNR webinar, which you can watch for free. And the basic idea is that you don't remove these cats, you spay and neuter them, And then you also TNR the surrounding neighborhoods. And in that way, you can defeat the vacuum effect. But simply removing them and hoping that nobody will ever show up does not work and has been tried umpteen million times without any success.
Do you need expert help taming feral kittens for adoption? Watch the Taming Feral Kittens and Cats full-length workshop video now available for free on the Urban Cat League YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com and search Urban Cat League to see all of their videos to benefit community cats. Ready for a grant challenge like no other? Mark your calendars for this inclusive 2024 Open Arms Challenge. For the entire month of April 2024, animal shelters, foster-based organizations, and public charities are encouraged to create a new program or expand an existing one focused on keeping pets and people together. Learn more about how to register and important dates at maddiesfund.org. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. No hook or plate setting needed. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order at livetrap.com.
So won't everybody freak out, you know, in your community when you say, we're going to take our cats and we're going to put them, some of them are feral, and we're going to put them right back on the street, right? That's the fear that shelters have is like, oh my God, you know, we're going to, you know, they're going to show up with pitchforks and burn the shelter down. Well, you know, we need to confront that fear. And so surveys have been done over the years, some of them older than others, but still useful information. So this was a national survey, and these surveys were commissioned by, obviously, by community cat advocacy groups, but they were conducted by, well-known and respected independent polling agencies like Gallup and that level. So the question was put to people, if you saw a stray cat and you only had two choices about what you could do, either leave the cat where he or she was outside or have the cat caught and euthanized, what would you consider to be more humane? And the answers were pretty startling. 81% said leave the cat where it is, and only 14% thought euthanasia was a good idea. In 2014, another survey commissioned by Best Friends Animal Society. This time they gave three choices, which was basically sterilize the cat, sterilize and vaccinate healthy stray cats, and then return them to where they are, you know, TNR, impoundment and euthanasia, or just don't do anything, just leave the cats alone to fend for themselves. And again, you can see the results. Between leave the cats alone and TNR, you've got like 3/4 of respondents wanting the cat to live, and a very clear majority who think that euthanasia is the right way to go. This was a survey of Ohio adults done by a researcher in 2008. And here's some of the things that they found. They found that 43% of participants, and we're talking about residents above the age of 18, almost half of them saw free roaming cats in their neighborhoods on a regular basis. And 1/4 of all respondents had actually fed free roaming cats during the prior year at once or more. And it also interestingly showed what the problem that, you know, we need to solve and have made a lot of progress since 2008, but of the people who were feeding free roaming cats, only 1/4 of them had brought the cat to a veterinarian. So that means only 1/4 of them had taken the next step to spay and neuter the cat. And the other 3/4 had just been feeding them, which of course meant they were feeding an overpopulation problem. But the point of all this is that when we dive into what do people really want, what do they think is the best thing to do with community cats? What we learn is that most people want them to live. So when it comes down to it, a return to field is actually aligned with the majority of the public who favor live outcomes, and euthanasia is aligned with the minority who don't want them around and who complain. And I think that's the key element, that the key factor to really identify here, which is if you're sitting in an animal control agency's call center or you're at the shelter, you know, and you're hearing from the public, who's calling, right? Is it the people who, you know, when we're talking about community cats, is it the people who prefer the cats to be, you know, is anybody calling up and saying, hey, I've got a, you know, a stray cat in my backyard. I put out some food occasionally. I enjoy having him around. Thanks so much for leaving him alone. Well, no, of course not. You don't get those calls. The calls you get are, there's a cat in my backyard. Get him out of here. I don't want him here. And that's the vast majority of what you're going to hear. And that can lead to a distortion and a belief that most of your service area, most of your community doesn't want the cats around. And that's a distortion you have to learn to see through, because it's not true. Because what these surveys suggest is that for every one person who calls you up and says, I don't want the cat around, there are three or four people in the community who do, who have no problem with the cat being there. You're just not hearing from them. So, you know, what are some of the fears of doing return to field that I think every new program has to face and is concerned about? So I think the number one is that since somebody brought the cat in who probably doesn't want the cat around, they're going to harm the cat if you put them back. And it's an understandable fear, but there's no empirical data to support it. We have not come upon a program yet that has documented a significant increase in animal abuse or cruelty or deaths of any kind associated with a return to field program. In Jacksonville, the seminal RTF program, they had this fear too, like everybody does. So I believe it was the first 6,000 cats that they released, they microchipped them because they wanted to see, are we going to find a lot more DOAs? Are they going to be, you know, are we going to be finding cats that were abused in some manner that were connected to the return to field program? And after the 6,000 cats, they didn't find anything different. So they stopped. They actually at that point stopped microchipping. Hopefully they've resumed it, because we have learned there's a lot of value to having microchips in community cats. Allows you to track their, you know, their history, connect them with a caretaker, things like that. With caretaker with respect to TNR, not so much with return to field, but with return to field, sometimes you can tell, you know, if a cat came from another location, and just gives you lots of clues about their history. So I digress, I'm sorry. But so yeah, it's a fear. And does it mean that you're always wrong about that? No, I mean, you know, sometimes there will be abuse. And one of the things we'll talk about in the second half of today's presentation is, you know, how do you learn to identify those relatively rare, but not, you know, non-existent situations where there really is a threat to the cat's safety? And that has a lot to do with the information you gather when the cat comes in. And if you identify a situation, maybe there have been poisonings in the area, maybe the person bringing in the cat has been suspected of animal abuse in the past, things like that, then you have to find a different outcome. But the vast majority of these cats are not going to be placed at additional risk by putting them back where they were doing well. So another fear is, well, people are going to complain to your municipal officials. You know, they're going to call up their city councilman or the mayor's office, and they're going to say, you know, I brought this cat in and now he's back. And, you know, what are they doing over there? And, you know, I'm not, you know, why are my taxpayer dollars going to, you know, causing me more problems? And the fact is, yes, people will complain. You know, those people who, that minority who supports euthanizing community cats are not going to like it when you when the shelter is no longer a dumping ground for cats in their area. So it's important that you educate your public officials about, doesn't mean you need their approval necessarily, depends on if you have a contract with them and what that, usually the contract only covers dogs and the shelters are free to make whatever policy they want about cats, but you still want them to know what you're doing and why, even if they don't fully support it, so that when people do start calling, they're not taken by surprise. And I would say, you know, my most persuasive argument when it comes to public officials about this program is, if there is any tie to taxpayer dollars, then the municipality and the shelter has a responsibility to use those dollars effectively and wisely. And there's nothing effective or wise about continuing a failed policy. Taking cats in and euthanizing them is not reducing the number of calls or the intake of cats or in any way showing improvement in the problem and the overpopulation issue, then you're just throwing good money after bad if you continue with this. So this program has been shown to have benefits. It doesn't make everybody happy, which no program ever will, but it's worth a try to see if something will work. So the more that policymakers understand what you're doing and the more they have your back, the easier it's going to be for you. Now, how about the fear that cat owners won't get a chance to reclaim their pets who get turned into the shelter? Well, unfortunately, the fact is that on average, only 2% of cats turned into shelters are ever reclaimed. And if you put them back in their territory, they have a far greater chance of returning home. And then obviously if you euthanize them, then they have no chance. So that's really not. Now, if there's some indicia that, you know, there's some indication that the cat is owned, like the cat has, you know, a collar or is chipped to somebody, then obviously you hold them and try to reunite them. But we're talking about, you know, a lot of cats, free roaming pets, do not have any form of identification on them.
And now, Brian, you're out there in the wings, and maybe we'll have time for a few questions before we get started on part two.
Yeah, I think that'd be great because, you know, part one was covering kind of the policy behind return to field, and part two, we're going to get to the nuts and bolts. So good time to take some policy questions.
Okay, great. So we'll take a look. And I know that there were some questions, you know, about neighbors and, you know, what if they, early on, there were some questions about, you know, what if the neighbors just don't want the cats, like at an apartment, what if the grocery says, so we got the grocery store says they'll do better at storing the garbage. We have, you know, apartment complex poisoning cats. And those kinds of questions. I think it's more about, like, you know, property issues that I think you've seen before in many places.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's a reason why we're trying to solve community cat overpopulation, because this is, you know, not always a great situation for the cats. When it comes to return to field, we're looking at animals coming into the shelter who are, as we'll discuss next, they're in good body, they have good body condition scores, they appear quite healthy, and that lets you know that they've been figuring it out, that they're surviving in their territory. And when you return them, you're not, they're not facing any more or fewer risks than they faced before they came into the shelter. And that allowing them to continue to navigate that environment is better than ending their lives. So the problems that are being described, like somebody doesn't want them there, or they, you know, they may be illegally trying to poison them or things like that. Those are dangers that are going to be present for cats, regardless of whether the cat is returned to field or not. So if the cat had never been brought in, he'd still be facing those dangers. So that's not to say that you should not make efforts to educate people, to let them know that something they're doing is a crime, to try to educate them that spay neuter is going to solve a lot of the issues in terms of nuisance and things like that. But the fact that there are going to be risks in the cat's environment is something that is always present. And the decision is made with a return to field program that those dangers, those ever-present dangers, do not justify ending the life of a healthy animal. Just as you wouldn't end the life of a squirrel because people may not like squirrels, or people may try to harm the other wildlife in the area. You don't go around euthanizing squirrels because of those risks. And for the same reasons, we don't do that for cats.
Okay. Is it better to have a scenario where we do know who the caretakers are for the cats that are out there versus return to field? You know, is there a different level of best practice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you can identify a caretaker, that's great. You know, because then you have somebody to work with in the community. You can try to work through any issues. If the cat comes back, into the shelter again, you know who to call. But typically with return to field situations, it's not the caretaker bringing the cat in. The caretaker probably wouldn't trap the cat for the purpose of surrendering them. So you don't usually have that information. I mean, if the shelter has the staff, you can go return cats to a community and then start knocking on doors and trying to gather information, and perhaps you'll be able to identify who the feeder or multiple feeders are. But usually that type of those types of manpower resources don't exist.
Right. I mean, I would say, I think that, like, if you're going to do a targeted project, as much information as you can get, the better, because obviously this targeted area has an impact on the intake in the shelter in your local community. So to be more intense with your resources makes sense. And then I think of return to field more in a more diffuse way. And that's sort of like the spread that like we spray it all around. And that's like what we do where it's more scattered and less focused, but yet still impactful, but a different type of impact.
Yeah, you're impacted with return to field, you're impacting euthanasia. But we will talk at the end of today's presentation about how you can combine return to field with targeted TNR to kind of get the best of both worlds.
Right. And there are a few questions here, and then we'll get going again about, you know, how does the public handle the thought about potentially returning friendly cats? Do we return friendly cats? How do we determine it's not an abandoned cat that needs rescue and adoption? So you may be talking about that in the second half too, accessing, you know, eligibility and that kind of thing. But that is a hot topic, it seems like, out there in the audience.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We will touch upon that. You know, I can just tell you that. So Neighborhood Cats is, we're involved in return to field programs. And in one, because of the kind of the legal situation in the community, we're the ones who decide ultimately whether cats go back or not. And we will return a friendly cat if there's evidence that that cat belongs in that community and has been there for a while and has a lot of support, because that's their home. If we are uncertain about whether a cat is abandoned or not, or we feel like it's an unsafe situation, then we will defer that cat for adoption. So basically what it comes down to for us is every cat needs to be individually assessed. What do you know about the circumstances they're living in? What were the circumstances that about them being surrendered to the shelter? What can we tell about their sociability level, about their health? And then an individual decision is made for each cat. So it's not a black or white thing. It's not like, oh, every cat that's 4 months old goes back, or we never return friendly cats, or we always return friendly cats. It's always a cat by cat assessment. And I think that's not doing that is where return to field programs can go wrong. But we'll talk about that in more detail.
Excellent. All right. Well, Brian, on to part two.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.